The church regularly receives questions from people, and these people have a background in the church or they wouldn't be asking about biblical statutes. You know what I mean by statutes? These laws that are mentioned in Leviticus and Exodus from the Old Testament. And people want to know if they are binding on Christians. There are probably two reasons why people of a Church of God background ask about biblical statutes. And if you're looking for a title of the sermon, that's it. Keep it simple for you. Biblical statutes. One reason is because in the early years of the church, and I'm talking about Worldwide Church of God or Radio Church of God, a great many of the members were farmers and ranchers, whether full-time or on a hobby basis. And they had cattle and or grain. And some thought then that conditions were such that we could apply at least some of the Old Testament statutes. Think immediately of the land Sabbath, for example. Maybe you think of the Jubilee. Maybe you think of the Sabbath or the statute about fruit trees. The other reason why people ask is that there does seem to be clear biblical indications that God intends his people to keep the statutes. If you take those statements at face value, the statements seem to end all discussion. And we'll look at some of those statements. And yet here's another statement. The statutes are not mentioned at all in the New Testament. Now that's quite a conundrum. Why so much said in the Old Testament? Why nothing in the New Testament? Today I will explain why the church teaches that most statutes are not binding on Christians today. There are a lot of places where I could go in the Old Testament and show you these things. You could take a concordance and look up the word statutes and find all of these places. But I want to look at a few highly significant places to illustrate the point. First of all, in Genesis 26. In the context here, there has been a famine, drought, and Isaac is considering taking his family down to Egypt, where apparently the drought had not struck. And he thought he'd be able to survive there and provide for his family. And God appeared to him. So it's very significant when God himself provides the words or speaks the words directly to Isaac. You really want to pay attention when God speaks. This is not just the Bible being inspired. That's truly important. But this is the Bible quoting God. Genesis 26, verse 2. "Do not go to Egypt," he said to Isaac. "Live in the land of which I shall tell you, dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father." That's the reason why this great country was a great country. Not because of the founding fathers and their courage, although they had courage. I've read a great deal about the founding fathers and politics and backstabbing and lying and lack of wisdom and immorality and so on was just as prone in the old days as it is in the present days. But the blessings of Abraham have been on this country. God says, "I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." God made a very specific point about the fact that Abraham kept his statutes. Another major section of the Old Testament deals with blessings and curses. Sometimes I hear the word cursings, which is not a word, but curses, blessings and curses. And actually, when you study history, it was common for a covenant to end with a list of this is what will happen if you do not live up to this covenant. This is what will happen if you do live up to this covenant. In other words, it was common at the end of a covenant to have a list of blessings and curses. By the way, hello to Aaron. It's good to see you here and recovering. I should have mentioned that earlier. So let's look at Leviticus 26 momentarily, where we find the end of God's covenant with Israel, the Old Covenant. There are many covenants in the Old Testament. You can get confused by trying to separate them all and talk about all the different ones. That's not the point today. But in Leviticus 26, I want to look at verse 3, first of all, and then verses 14 and 16. Leviticus 26, verse 3. If you walk in my statutes, says God, and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in its season, the land will yield its produce, the trees of the field will yield their fruit. I don't know if you're aware of the huge problem the southwestern United States has right now with the water table going down. Lake Mead, which is a water source for Las Vegas, is dropping a foot a day. And yet, all the contents of Lake Mead, hundreds of millions of gallons of water, cubic feet of water, have been lost underneath the ground. And they've just discovered that. And the Southwest is in very serious trouble. Obviously, we're not getting the blessings that God promised. He goes on to say in verse 14 now, but if you do not obey me and do not observe these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you do not perform all my commandments, but break my covenant, I also will do this to you. And then follows the list of the curses with which you are familiar, and I'm sure you have studied many times. Another major time in the history of Israel to look at is when God gave the Ten Commandments. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 5. At the end of chapter 4, if you look at how the commandments are introduced, you'll find Moses referencing the statutes there. If you read the first part of chapter 5, before God gives the Ten Commandments, you'll find Moses talking about the statutes. But I want to look at verses 29 through 31. This is from God himself after he wrote those Ten Commandments and gave them to Moses for Israel. Verse 29, God said, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep my commandments. He knew the people of Israel, and he knew that their heart was not in possession of him. He knew that his Holy Spirit was not living in them, and that they therefore would not be able to obey him. And it's almost a groan that you hear from him. Oh, that they would always fear me and keep my commandments, that it might be well with them and their children forever. Now, go and say to them, he's talking to Moses, return to your tents. Okay, this is it. The ceremony is done. You've heard the commandments. Go back to your tents. But as for you, he says to Moses, you stand here by me, and I will speak to you all the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I am giving to them to possess. So the statutes were extremely important to God right after giving the Ten Commandments, and he's going to give them to Moses. When Solomon was crowned by King David, you remember all the fooferah leading up to that, and another son almost stole the crown, and Bathsheba intervened with the head of the military, and Solomon actually got the crown as was intended. Let's read what David said to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 2. This is the charge King David gave to Solomon, who later went on to lead Israel to be in its so-called golden age, when it was the richest, wealthiest, most powerful nation. It's hard to imagine little bitty Israel there in the Middle East being the most powerful nation, but indeed it was under King Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 3. David said to his son, and keep the charge of the Eternal your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. And I might just interject that at this point, there were statutes written in the first five books of the Bible, the Torah. It's mostly Leviticus and Exodus where you find statutes are written, as is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you turn, that the Eternal may fulfill his word, which he spoke concerning me when he said, if your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Another area to look at in Israel's history is, why did God send Israel into captivity? Somebody asked me recently, asked the church, who was the second woman born on earth? Or who was the second woman on earth? Something we all wonder about when we go to bed, isn't it? Who was the second woman on earth? And I answered the question. Of course, you cannot say by name who it was, but it was one of the daughters of Adam and Eve, was the second woman on earth. But I went on to explain that God did not give all of the details in the Bible. He stuck with his purpose. His purpose was to work with humankind until he found the man through whom a line would be produced and a nation produced that he could choose to be his model nation. He found that man in Abraham and that nation in Israel. And then the Bible focuses upon Israel and its history so that Israel could be a model of all God's way of life to all nations and the blessings could come to all nations. But Israel failed. The nation split. It became a northern kingdom that retained the name Israel, the northern kingdom did not retain the name Israel. The southern kingdom retained the name Israel. But both areas were eventually taken into captivity. God brushed his hands, erased it, or washed his hands of them. Why did God break away from Israel? Ezekiel tells us, he was one of the main prophets who wrote about it, even though he was in captivity at the time. And he was, by the way, up in the area of the Tigris-Euphrates beginning area, in the area between Syria and Iraq, where the Al-Qaeda lookalikes have gone through, or the insurgents have gone through, or the Syrian fighters have gone through. It seems that certain areas of the world remain choke points forever. Ezekiel was up in that area when God gave him this message for Israel. Now, it related back to Israel and told him what happened to them, but it relates to Israel of the future as well. Ezekiel 11, verse 12. Ezekiel 11, verse 12. And you Israel, shall know that I am the Eternal, for you have not walked in my statutes, nor executed my judgments, for you have done according to the customs of the Gentiles, which were all around you. Same question needs to be asked about why God sent Judah into captivity. Northern kingdom left. He had a kingdom that retained. There was Judah. Benjamin joined them. Then the Levites eventually came down. There were three tribes together. So you had the priesthood, you had the temple, you had a model nation. God could have continued with them and tried to continue with them, but then he reached the point at which he broke from them. And Jeremiah is inspired to tell us why. Jeremiah chapter 44. Jeremiah 44, verse 11, or verse 10 and verse 11. Jeremiah 44:10, they have not been humbled, meaning the Jews, the Benjamites, and the Levites, to this day, nor have they feared. They have not walked in my law or in my statutes that I have set before you and your fathers. Thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will set my face against you for catastrophe and for cutting off all of you, Judah. And so Judah was indeed cut off. So it seems that there's good reason to keep the statutes, or there's good reason for anybody reading the Bible, reading these scriptures, studying the Bible, and wanting to follow God, to want to look at these statutes and, wow, I want to be sure that I'm keeping them. I don't want to be caught out and make sure that, or find out, as Judah, Israel, other people that God was not able to use, that he can't use me. But then, as I mentioned, how many times are statutes mentioned in the New Testament? Zero. Zip, zero, nada. How can that be? How can there be such emphasis on statutes in the Old Testament and then seemingly no emphasis on them in the New Testament? The absence of the mention of the Old Testament statutes begs the question that there must be more to know than what we read on the surface about statutes. Taken only at face value, it seems as though the statutes are a unique and permanent body of laws, like the commandments. You have the statutes, so you can take a book off the shelf, and those are the statutes. You have the Ten Commandments, you can take that book off the shelf and open it up, and here are the ten. It seems like they're the same. They are not. And therein lies the confusion. There is not a single book of law called the statutes. Well, what's all this that I just read to you about the statutes and the judgments and the law? Well, the law is a book. The Ten Commandments, you know, and remains. It remained in the New Testament Church of God. Let me explain the meaning of the word statute. Go back to Genesis 26 and the verses that I read there to you where it says Abraham kept the statutes. What is the word for statute there? It is a noun meaning a statute, an ordinance, anything prescribed, means anything that is ordered or prescribed. This is from, by the way, the Complete Word Study Dictionary, edited by Zodiades. It serves as the feminine of the word H and long O and then Q, and I believe it's pronounced hawk. As though you got something in your throat. So a statute is a hawk, not a bird that flies, but it is a hawk. Since its basic meaning is not specific, the word takes on different connotations in each context in which it's used. Oh, well, that's a revelation. Because it sounded like it meant the same thing every time it was used. Its most common meaning is decrees, statutes, or a synonym of these words. The decrees of the Lord could be oral, or they could be written. But something that God decreed and said, like what he said to Moses, was a statute. Or what he said to Ezekiel was a statute. Or what he said to Jeremiah was a statute. It was a decree. So we have to understand how much emphasis to put on these words or how to understand these words. And I'm taking time to go through this to hopefully carefully explain it so that we will understand it. Some more background on Genesis 26. All this, God said, because Abraham obeyed me. Here the words were, quote, obeyed my voice. And kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws. And this is what the Bible of the Bible Knowledge Commentary says. David C. Cook. He doesn't translate the word statutes as statutes. He translates it as decrees. Moses kept my requirements, my commands, my decrees, and my laws. And then he makes this comment. This phrase. My requirements, my commandments, my decrees, and my laws are standard terms in the legal literature of the Old Testament. So when there is a statement made about law, that is why you find this list of words. I hate to use the comparison, but it's legal jargon. When you go to an attorney and you're doing something with an attorney and he or she says, well, don't worry, that's just so much legal jargon. That has to be added to every document. These words were added every time something legal was spoken of. Well, that's confusing. I don't want it to be that way. I want it to be much simpler. Well, too bad. So do I. But it is able to simplify it. And that's what I'm trying to do by going through this in the sermon. And I think you'll see as we apply judgment for one of the things that is mentioned here, we're able to see where the statutes fit in. In other words, the purpose was not to spell out unique codes that Abraham followed, but rather God's eternal law. Isaac wasn't being told that Abraham followed certain things and not others, but that Abraham followed me. That's what God was saying. I will bless you if you'll follow me, like your father followed me. Now, some decrees were given, and by that I mean a statute. Some statutes were given to counter a unique problem, as opposed to giving a law that stands forever. They were given to counter a unique problem, just like today, and again by analogy, there's this extreme problem of immigration, and there are decrees being made all of the time, regulations being given out all of the time. In Leviticus chapter 20, we're going to look right in the heart of some of the statutes, and I'm going to show you this point, that some statutes were given just to counter problems at the time. Leviticus chapter 20, we'll look at verses 22 and 23. It starts out in Leviticus 20, verse 22, "You shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my judgments and perform them, that the land where I am bringing you to dwell may not vomit you out." This is the land of Canaan. I want you to stay there. I want you to succeed. I want you to be blessed and to be the blessing for all nations. "And you shall not walk in the statutes of the nation which I am casting out before you, for they commit all these things, and I abhor them." So the statutes that you read of in Leviticus 20, the decrees, are to counter the decrees that existed in the local tribes that lived around Israel at the time. They dealt with specific problems of the time. How do we know which statute dealt with a specific problem? Well, here you have to turn to commentaries. And sometimes commentaries have historical background and they can tell you why certain things were done. Sometimes, frankly, they don't know. And if the authors are honest, they will tell you they don't know. There's some things I'll explain to you where they know and some that they don't. Another thing for you to understand about the statutes is that God did not give the same statutes to every generation. What? He says all the way through, you've got to keep my statutes. You didn't keep my statutes. He didn't give the same ones to everybody. Can I prove that? Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy is the second book. It's the second look. It's the second introduction to the land of Canaan. It was written and spoken to the generation that grew up in the wilderness and was going to inherit the land. All of the parents died during the 40 years of wandering. And Deuteronomy summarizes everything that went before, summarizes why Israel failed, the first generation, and what Israel needed to do to succeed in the second generation. The first generation got Leviticus and Exodus and all of the statutes that are included therein. Now we come to the second generation. Verse 1, "These are the statutes and judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord your God is giving your fathers to give you to possess all the days that you live on the earth." Now it sounds like he's going to repeat the statutes of Leviticus and Exodus. But again, we turn to David Cook in the Bible Knowledge Commentary, and he points out that the decrees and laws that follow after you read verse 1 were not meant to be exhaustive. You read from all the way through chapter 26 and verse 15, from chapters 12 through 26. It's a long ways. 14 chapters of Deuteronomy are not an exhaustive repetition of statutes of the past. Cook continues, "Moses intentionally did not repeat many details and laws recorded in Exodus and Leviticus. Deuteronomy is law preached, or better said, it is instruction. Moses was setting a quality of living before the nation rather than an exhaustive law code that covered every detail of life." So that's one way to control people. You know, on Tuesday you turn right. On Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock you go there. If you need to tie your shoe, you do this. And of course the Pharisees got into making all kinds of decrees or statutes later on. And so did many rabbis make many statutes and decrees down through history and became part of the oral traditions. That's one way to control people. The approach that Jesus taught and that we teach in the Church of God today is understanding God's intent, understanding God's mind and God's nature and using God's Ten Commandments, which is a book that you can take off the shelf. It is a permanent, eternal set of laws. And by that, making good judgments on how to live. And that's more how the book of Deuteronomy is written. That's more how the second generation was guided as they went into the land of Canaan. And that is not to say that they were without statutes. I don't want to imply that. They did follow many of the earlier statutes, but I want to show that the statutes were changing. They were different. And I'm showing you these things out of God's own mouth or out of Moses' own mouth. I want to clarify something about the statutes that God commanded Solomon to keep when David said that. This is from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. I just have BKC and I always have to remember what that means. The Bible Knowledge Commentary says, Solomon was encouraged to be strong and keep the word of the Lord. He should show himself to be a man by being brave, to stand for the right, and to stand against the wrong. And there have been many leaders in this country who have done that, and many individuals in their homes who have done that. He should observe what the Lord requires in the sense of obeying Yahweh. What the Lord requires is to walk in His ways, namely, to keep His decrees, ordinances, and commands. Today we would say to live God's way of life, to keep His laws, His requirements, and His testimonies. These four words, decrees, commands, laws, requirements, refer to different kinds of precepts in the Mosaic Law. Precepts, principles, not a book of law that you take and you look and you say, this is what I do with my land, this is what I do in counting the years of tithing, etc., which is what you have in the statutes. A statute is not a unique word for a body of law like the Ten Commandments is. God did not give statutes for every nation. This may be a surprise to you, but it's really something to think about and helps you understand the statutes. Who was the king of Israel? Who was the first king of Israel? God. God was the first king of Israel. He was the sovereign. So who gave Israel its first civil laws? You know the difference between spiritual law and civil law? A civil law is a parking ordinance out here says a $250 fine if you park in a handicapped spot without a handicap sticker or placard on your car. That's a civil ordinance. A spiritual ordinance is this is the Sabbath, and this is why we're meeting here. Or the Feast of Tabernacles is coming up. That is a spiritual ordinance. The holy days are spiritual ordinances. The food laws are physical, have to do with the physical body, but they have a spiritual connotation. And the New Testament church retained them. Those are the main statutes or laws that are eternal, that existed before the statutes were given and continue to exist afterwards. But insofar as the statutes that were given to Israel and later to Judah, they were national laws. They're not strictly for all nations or all cultures any more than American law today could be applied to everybody living in Spain. Spain has its own national laws, and America has unique national laws. Now, even in America, America doesn't follow the statutes that were legal in the 1800s. I always remember, it's always a joke to look at what the statutes were, maybe statutes that are still on the book. When I was in Pasadena in the 1960s, it was illegal to shoot a buffalo from a moving streetcar. That was still a law on the book. And I say a law, it was a civil law. It was a statute, an American law. And I don't think it's legal even today to shoot a buffalo from a moving streetcar, but there are many other statutes that have been changed, and especially as they're recognized for many, many years. Most states had statutes making it illegal to commit adultery. Imagine that. I think there are still some states that have those. But not all statutes for Americans can even be applied today. Now, there's one major flaw in this comparison, and I'm sure you see it right away. The statutes that God gave came from Him. They didn't come from the American fathers. They didn't come from some competing council members who wanted a city or a town ordinance. They reflected God's thinking. The statutes showed what God had in mind. And for that reason, we can and should often look to the foundational principle behind the statute. Maybe God gave a statute because of a certain thing being done by the people living around Israel at the time, but there is an application that can be followed today. And that is true, and I will show you some instances of that by some sample letters that we've received on statutes. We're going to go through a couple of them. We commonly receive letters from people who either want to know about statutes or want to argue that the statutes are still applying. The first statute that I'm going to deal with is an argument that we still should wear tassels, and on the bottom of the tassels should be a blue thread strung through the bottom of it. I've been in Church of God services where people have shown up who come from Messianic Jewish-type organizations and wear kind of a jacket with tassels. The word tassels, by the way, seems to come from a Hebrew word that means flower, and that's as far as it goes. Linguists and historians do not know exactly what the tassels look like or what they were. But if you read in Numbers 15, I'll read this with you, Numbers 15:38, just so that we know what we're talking about, this is a statute. And here in Numbers is another one of the books of Moses. Speak to the children of Israel. This is God's order. Verse 38. Tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a blue thread on the tassel of the corners. Now, throughout their generations is like saying forever. And I hope you understand that the connotation of the language is so long as the circumstances under which this is given continue to exist. It doesn't mean for every generation. If it did, then we'd all be wearing tassels. I'd have them and you'd have them on. But it means so long as the circumstances continue. You shall have the tassel that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord to do them, and that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined, referring to the inclination of human nature, and that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy for your God. That was the fundamental purpose for the statutes, so that the people of God would be holy because God is holy. Why did God require, and pardon the example, people to bury their waste when they went out of the camp? Because he did not want anything to defile the place where he was. The camp was always to be holy because it had the presence of God. I am the Eternal, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Eternal, your God. And that ending statement, I am the Eternal, your God, is kind of like putting that red stamp of an official on a document. This is a statute from God. Ka-chunk. Here's the red stamp. This is official. So, why do we not keep the statute today? Well, the underlying principle of the statute is what? That you should always have blue thread? That you should always wear clothes that have little blossoms on them? No, the underlying principle is to live by God's law. And to always remember God's law. Where is God's law now? What's the reminder of God's law now? Hebrews 8, verse 10 says, it is written on our hearts. We don't have to have it on our clothing when it's in the mind. It's a much better place to have it in the mind. You know, what's a better thing, you know, a better reminder? You have to do something to have a sticker on your computer or have a program running on your computer. That's the difference, to have a piece of paper with a note written on it to remind you of something or to have it already going. The commandments are already running, so to speak. The program is already working in your mind. You don't need to turn back the clock to the 1800s and shooting buffalo. You don't have to turn back the clock to Numbers 15 and put tassels on your clothing. Having the Spirit of God, having God himself and his mind right there butting up against your human nature and ready to remind your human nature constantly of the existence of his law is far superior to a tasseled garment. And it surpasses it. The need for a tasseled garment is surpassed. And that's why we do not wear them. Now, some statutes were given to Israel, as I've said, because of the worshiping of other cultures or the worship of other cultures around them. Leviticus 19:27 is a good example. And people ask about this. You shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edges of your beard. So, no marine cuts, zoop, no butches, where the hair is all cut off, and don't you dare make your beard round. Can't do that. Well, does that apply? Why was that law given? It's a statute. Do we keep it today? Well, at the time, surprisingly, the sun was worshipped. And I say that sarcastically because the sun is still being worshipped today. That is the heart and core of anti-God worship, and that is to go worship the physical sun. That's Satan's inspiration. Sun worshippers at the time would cut their hair and their beards as round as possible in order to imitate the sun. Some of them cut little round circles in the top of their hair and the back of their head. Some of them cut their hair in such a way that it looked round, and they cut their beard in such a way that it was perfectly round, anything to imitate the sun. And, of course, they had all kinds of holidays involved as well and many other practices to follow the sun. Now, what do we do today? Do we tell men today, don't have your hair cut short on the side of your heads, don't trim your beard? No. But we do say, don't worship the sun. We do look at the application. We do look at the foundation. And the foundation is do not worship the sun. So we do not keep Sunday. We do not keep Christmas. We do not keep Easter. We do not follow all of the practices of much of Christendom around us, which is wrapped around and embraces the same thing that the hill tribes are embracing, worshiping the sun. We do not do that. There would be nothing wrong with having a rounded beard if you would like to do that today, but there would be something wrong with worshiping the sun. Example number two, second letter, asked about the land Sabbath. This is from Leviticus 25. And this is every cycle of 7 years, the land was to be let fallow. Let grow volunteer, rather, not fallow in the sense of how modern farmers do it and plow it and leave it open for the sake of getting more moisture, and it's actually a method of forcing growth rather than helping the land. But Israel was to let the land lie fallow 1 year in a cycle of seven. What's the statute about? Well, it's about land management and it's about conservation. There's nothing spiritual about it. It ensured that Israel wouldn't deplete the land through overuse, that it would continue to produce as long as the people live there. Now, the principle can be applied today. The difference between a principle and a law is important to understand. There are principles behind the statutes. They can guide your thinking or your judgment. What are the judgments? Judgments are decisions made upon the basis of guidance or law. Some people say judgments are case law. You know, judges study judgments that have been made. The Bible talks about keeping the statutes and the judgments. God made judgments. He said, you know, you did this, so now I'm going to do that. That's a judgment. He gave decrees where he said, sometimes if a person does X, then Y is the consequence. Well, that's a judgment. Now, you look at this law about the land Sabbath, and then you decide what you're going to do if you have land to manage. And then you are making a judgment. The principles help you make judgments. What's the difference between that and a law? A law requires a specific action. The Ten Commandments require specific actions. It breaks the Ten Commandments to commit abortion. It is murder. It breaks the Ten Commandments to live together without marriage. It is adultery or the spirit of adultery. Those are laws. They require actions. There's no negotiation. There's no thinking about, no. It's either you obey or you do not obey. That's the difference between a principle and a law. Not keeping a law would be a sin. Now, when you study the New Testament, there is no evidence whatsoever that the New Testament Church of God considered it a sin to fail to keep the statutes. It shows that God helped them understand the statutes were not laws in the sense that the Ten Commandments are laws. Otherwise, they would have approached them differently, and God would have led them to approach the subject differently. Now, regarding the land Sabbath, the way Israel kept it was the entire nation on the seventh year let their land grow volunteer, and poor people were able to take the crops that grew volunteer. You know, carrots come up all the time, sometimes peas do, and beans and so on. And okay, so now let's say we're going to keep the land cycle. Now, when are we going to do it? Well, let's just pick a year and everybody do it the same year. How would that work? Well, wait a minute, I just came into the church. You want me to do it now? Well, I've been in the church only 2 years. Well, you know, I don't really own my land, I rent my land. Well, you know, the people all around my land are farming and spraying and doing everything, and if I just let my land go, it's going to be sprayed with all kinds of stuff. We run into a multitude of problems if we try to say, okay, here is 1 year when you will keep the land Sabbath. We can't calculate by astrology and the calendar and figure out when the land Sabbath was in Israel. But most importantly, the Church of God, by God's design, is scattered in many nations and many cultures, and it's not possible for all of us as a church to keep the land Sabbath as a nation. What can we do? We can rotate crops. We can plant crops that are nitrogen fixing, that put nutrients back into the soil. We can let land lie fallow for a crop cycle and let it grow volunteer for the sake of the land resting if you have land to manage, and stop to think about the fact that now most in the Church of God are not ranchers or farmers. Many have hobby gardens, but many in cities don't even have hobby gardens anymore. And would God have a body of statutes that he'd have 1% of his church live or die by sin not to do it? No, that's not how God works. There is a body of laws by which we live or die, and that is the Ten Commandments. It includes the festivals, and it includes the food laws, because the New Testament Church of God kept them, and we have evidence that they did. Properly following these principles is a good thing. Now, another question that often comes up is the fruit tree. The regulation said that you could not eat from the fruit tree until the fourth year. I'm going to read to you from the New King James Study Bible comment on this. The most common reason suggested for this regulation is that young fruit trees need to preserve their strength rather than putting it into their fruit. In that case, the owner would probably have clipped off the blossoms in the first 3 years. See, it wasn't just that you don't use it. You have to clip the blossoms off in order for the nutrients to go back into the plant. And then in the fourth year, it was a kind of first fruits, this commentary says, and I don't know if they have that right. But the fifth year, the harvest belonged to the owner. That's when you could begin to use the crop and the tree would produce the best. Faithfulness in observing this regulation was rewarded by increase in the production of fruit from the fifth year on. Could this be applied today? Sure. If you have a fruit tree, first 3 years that you own it, you can pull the buds or pull the blossoms off of it. Make sure you get them all so that the nutrients go to the tree. And then the fruit of the fourth year just drops to the ground and goes back and fertilizes the ground. And then the fifth year, you can use the fruit. You can do that. When you buy fruit, make sure you know how old it is when you buy it, because it may already be 2 or 3 years old. I was talking to a minister recently who had bought some blueberries, and with the instructions that came with the blueberries, it said, for X number of years, just pick the blossoms off and don't use the fruit. And that way you'll have a good, strong plant. But notice the language even in this Bible commentary. The most common reason suggested, the owner of the fruit tree probably. In other words, the scholars who have studied the history of these statutes do not know exactly why God gave them. God didn't explain why. Now, does God want us all to do whatever it is that we're supposed to do with fruit trees without even explaining all the details, and when most of us don't even have fruit trees, and if you happen to have a fruit tree, are you supposed to do this? Use your good judgment on what you do with your fruit tree. But it is a principle, and apparently it is good for fruit trees. But it is not a spiritual law. There is something mentioned in the New Testament which is a statute, even though it's not called that, and it became a test case. And it truly illustrates the entire issue of statutes and commandments. That is circumcision. God commanded Abraham to be circumcised. Genesis 17. This is the sign of the covenant that I'm making with you. Can't get more direct than that. And Abraham at 99 had to be circumcised and circumcised all the grown men in his household and had his 13-year-old son circumcised. He really took it seriously. And then later on, all of the people of Israel, all the males of Israel before they left Egypt, before they kept the Passover, were circumcised. According to Exodus chapter 12, verses 44 through 48, God commanded that anybody who wants to keep the Passover with you has to be circumcised. But then we read again, I read further in the history of Israel. We go through 40 years of wandering. The first generation dies, the men who are circumcised, and then the generation of men that's ready to conquer the land of promise is not circumcised. Joshua chapter 5, verse 5, Joshua says, none of you were circumcised, and yet it was a statute. Leviticus 12, verse 3, on the eighth day the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Israel had that statute for 40 years. God said, keep my statutes. They were led by Moses, who was supposed to teach him to keep the statutes. And yet not a single male was circumcised. Why not? I don't know. It's a puzzle. A question to be asked in the future. But you can read in the history in Joshua there that before they conquered the land, Joshua circumcised all of those adult male soldiers. And he even gave a colorful name to the place where it happened. By the way, if you read all of Leviticus 12, you will see what I mean by some things can be applied very readily and some things can't. I just read to you where you can circumcise a male on the eighth day as long as the vitamin K level is okay in the body, in the blood. These are things doctors check. Then it can be done as long as there's no jaundice. These are other issues that come up. But you can arrange to have a child circumcised on the eighth day. But then another statute that follows right after that, it says that a woman is unclean so many days after having a male child and is unclean double the time after having a female child. It's the same chapter. Now, we have to be careful, brethren. Is it just to cherry-pick a statute? I'm coming down to the Bible. Here's the statute I can keep. So therefore, I'm keeping the statutes. And all this stuff about being unclean and turtle doves and going to the priest. Well, I'm not going to do that because you can't do that. The priesthood is done away with. Is that really keeping the statutes? No, that's pretending to keep the statutes. That's not really keeping the statutes with understanding. You look at the principles involved. Should a male be circumcised on the eighth day? God did not explain why. I don't know why. I don't know what the pagans were doing at the time. There are doctors who say that it's good for you. There are doctors who say that it's not good for you. It is a personal decision. People in the Church of God are not required to have their children circumcised on the eighth day, nor are men who come into the Church of God required to be circumcised before they're baptized. Now, interestingly, the Old Testament records the spirit and intent of this law. You don't have to wait for the New Testament on this. Deuteronomy 10, verse 16 says, therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. The point of the circumcision law was to illustrate the need for cutting off human nature from the heart so that a person could be converted. It's mentioned again in Deuteronomy 30, verse 6. It's mentioned again in Jeremiah 4, verse 4. So God inspired spiritual understanding to be recorded in the Old Testament. He also inspired the record that statutes had an underlying spiritual principle. So if you look and you look carefully, this information is there. There was a time, and you know this history, when a group of influential church members, probably they were all Jewish, or they were Jewish proselytes for sure, but probably Jews, tried to stir up a controversy over this statute. And they wanted the church to make an order and say that every male had to be circumcised in order to become a member of the Church of God and keep, as they said, the law of Moses. And wow, they could read the Old Testament scriptures that could prove that. I only read a few of them to you that mentioned the statutes. They could have made a very strong case. I don't think any stronger case could be made than going to Genesis 17 to Abraham, the father of the faithful, and read that. They wanted a strict adherence to what they thought the statute required. Now, you know the history. The Acts 15 conference was held. They decided the issue. If a case could have been made that this statute about circumcision still applied, where would it stop? Couldn't a case be made for other statutes to be applied and to be observed? What about the unwritten statutes? Remember, a statute or a decree is anything God said, not just what was written down. And rabbis down through the ages have said God said, and they have an extreme body of oral traditions that have been put together in what they call the Talmud. And then another group of Jews, I learned recently, disagreed with that, and there's a Talmud 2, Talmud version 2, of all the oral traditions. Where would this stop? They could continue to argue forever that all of these things should be observed. Well, as the church decided, as you know, the church discussed it. Church was allowed to discuss it. And there were people who would have been directly involved. There were Gentiles and there were Jews as well. The elders were involved in the discussion. And a final decision was made by the church leadership that the law of circumcision, the statute, was not binding on Christians, which has far-reaching complications. There are indications that the argument of this never completely died, that throughout the rest of the first century, there were people, little pockets of people who went around, and they'd get together in small groups, maybe after church or in people's homes, and they'd argue, well, I really think circumcision should be kept, should be observed. A very telling scripture in Galatians chapter 6 that I'd like you to turn to. Galatians 6, verse 12. I'll read verse 13 as well. Galatians was a church that was troubled, whether by people inside it or people who visited it, about this doctrine of keep the statute of circumcision. Verse 12 says, as many as desire to make a good showing in the flesh, these would compel you to be circumcised. They considered it a coup. They considered it a great achievement if they could convince others to accept their doctrine, only that they may not suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. They are not willing to do everything that a Christian should do. For not even those who are circumcised keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised that they may boast in your flesh. It's a very telling statement. It means that they were circumcised, but they weren't keeping the law of God, the Ten Commandments. They were following what they thought was a book of statutes that you could pull off the shelf, and they were written down eventually in the 5th century in a book, I think it was, in the Talmud, and became a book. But instead, they ignored the book that could be pulled off the shelf. What did Abraham do? He followed God's way of life, which embodied God's mind and his law and kept his commandments. He learned the principles of the statutes. Well, he hadn't given the statutes. They hadn't been given yet, even though it said he kept the statutes. That's interesting, isn't it? He followed the decrees before they were given. How could he do that? He knew God's mind is what it meant. And that's what the words mean all the way through. And here you find people who were so focused on the individual statute that they lost the principle, which is to obey God's law. That's the heart of the matter. Keeping the statutes does not convert a person. And that tells you as well whether it's a spiritual law. Keeping the statutes does not convert a person. Proof, Galatians 6, 12 and 13. God is looking for an inner nature that's inclined to obey his commandments out of love for him. In the book of Romans, Paul repeated the Old Testament spiritual principle, the one I read to you from Deuteronomy that's in Jeremiah as well and mentioned again in Deuteronomy, Romans 2, verses 28 and 29. For he is a Jew, he is not a Jew, who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. When he says a Jew outwardly, he's obviously referring to the physical statute here. What is a Jew? And he's talking about a spiritual Jew, a spiritual son of God or a spiritual son of Abraham. He is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. Now, I confess that if I lived in that time, and if I'd been brought up in a Jewish background, and I'd studied the Old Testament history, I think I personally would have had difficulty understanding that the statute of circumcision is done away with, because I can see how important it was to the Jews. But I'm glad that I live now and I can look back at history and see the entire picture and the entire issue of statutes. Lastly, one last scripture, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 19. He wrote to Corinth. Apparently, the Corinthian church was also troubled by people who wanted to keep the statutes, especially this statute of circumcision. 1 Corinthians 7, 19. Circumcision is nothing. Oh, what a powerful statement. When you read Genesis 17, when you read Exodus 12, Genesis 17 about Abraham, Exodus 12 about the Israelites before they were removed from Egypt, Joshua 5 about the Israelites before they conquered the land, Leviticus 12, which orders the circumcision on the eighth day, and then you read in the New Testament, circumcision is nothing. It means the statute is nothing. It's not something that's eternal to be followed forever. But uncircumcision is nothing. What is done physically makes no difference. But keeping the commandments of God, that is the body of law, which requires action. That is what matters. Thereby, this statute that God told Moses to give to Israel, the decree that God gave to Abraham, is clearly only an illustration of what really matters, keeping God's commandments. And just as clearly, not all statutes, and the reason I'm saying that is some statutes are, but not all statutes are part of God's eternal commandments. What statutes are? Very simply, the Ten Commandments, which includes the Sabbath, the festivals. These are mentioned in the statutes, but they're mentioned before and they're mentioned afterwards. And the physical laws that have to do with food. We'll have to ask God in the future to explain why he included those in the requirements, but he did. It's written in the book, and it's clear as can be. That is why the Church of God does not require Christians to keep the statutes.